From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. In April, the British tabloid News of the World apologized for hacking. The paper had accessed the cell phone voicemail messages of politicians and celebrities. The incident embarrassed Rupert Murdoch's News International, which owns the paper. It had originally denied the claims. Now, as NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik reports, a new twist has drawn harsh scrutiny to one of Murdoch's top executives.
The story this time centers not on coverage of a movie star nor a footballer, not a cabinet secretary nor a prince, but a schoolgirl, an abducted 13-year-old British girl, Millie Dowler, who disappeared in 2002.
At last, the man responsible for the cruel murder of our darling daughter so many years ago has been found guilty.
That was Millie's mother, Sally Dowler, on the courthouse steps just last month after a man was convicted of killing the girl. Now the British newspaper The Guardian is reporting that a private investigator hired by the Sunday tabloid News of the World had been hacking into Millie's mobile voicemail messages days after her disappearance. Alan Rusbridger, The Guardian's editor-in-chief, says British tabloids have gotten, if anything, hungrier for a scoop.
There's something ugly that has taken over in the last 10 years, driven by, I think, a feeling that people in public life didn't deserve any privacy at all.
As Rusbridger says, this hacking episode interfered with an intense police search for a girl.
The private investigator started deleting the messages because the voicemail was full and they wanted to have a constant flow of messages. This raised the hopes of the parents, who thought that must mean that she's still alive. This took it onto a new level of revulsion.
Ford will no longer advertise in News of the World, that nation's largest circulation Sunday paper, and there are calls for the firing of Rebecca Brooks, the executive over Murdoch's British newspapers, who was editor of News of the World at the time. British Prime Minister David Cameron took time at a press conference in Afghanistan earlier today to address the allegations.
If they are true, this is a truly dreadful act and a truly dreadful situation.
Now listen to what Cameron also felt compelled to say.
The police in our country are quite rightly independent, but they should feel they should investigate this without any fear, without any favor, without any worry about where the evidence should lead them. They should pursue this in the most vigorous way that they can in order to get to the truth of what happened.
Allegations have surfaced that police officials cut short an earlier investigation because of cozy ties they had with News of the World and other influential Murdoch papers. The newest allegations have so far not been denied, and they have led Rebecca Brooks to email her staff to say she was completely unaware of the hacking. Her signature issue at News of the World was an anti-pedophile campaign, so the allegation that her paper interfered with the police inquiry into the abduction of a girl cuts at the heart of her record. News International's Simon Greenberg, her spokesman, did not reply to my request for comment, but he said this in an interview with the BBC.
We're absolutely shocked and appalled by what we read about yesterday, which was the first time we were aware of it. We're absolutely determined to establish the facts, to get to the bottom of it, and if they are true, then the strongest possible action will be taken.
It's a far more contrite tone than the company adopted in 2009. After paying £1 million settlement to keep details of a similar hacking incident quiet, the company blamed a few bad apples and condemned The Guardian as a rival playing dirty. Now it says it wants answers, and that News International, under former News of the World editor Rebecca Brooks, will find them. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
In a poll of librarians, teachers, publishers, and authors, the trade magazine Publishers Weekly asked for a list of the best children's books ever published in the United States. Hands down, the number one book was E.B. White's Charlotte's Web. Now a new book called The Story of Charlotte's Web explores how White's masterpiece came to be. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
One early fall morning in 1949, E.B. White walked into the barn of his farm in Maine and saw a spider web. That in itself was nothing new, but this web, with its elaborate loops and whorls that glistened with the morning dew, caught his attention. Weeks passed until one cold October evening when he noticed that the spider was spinning what turned out to be an egg sac. White never saw the spider again, and so when he had to return later that fall to New York City to his job as a regular contributor to the New Yorker magazine, White took out a razor blade and cut the silken egg sac out of the web. He put the sack in an empty candy box, punched some holes in it, and absent-mindedly put the box atop his bedroom bureau in New York. Weeks later, a movement on that bureau alerted him to the fact that tiny spiderlings were making a great escape through the air holes in the candy box. White was delighted at this affirmation of life and left the hundreds of barn spiderlings alone for the next week or so to spin webs from his hairbrush to his nail scissors to his mirror, until finally the cleaning lady complained. Thus was hatched the idea for Charlotte's Web, White's magical meditation on the passage of time, mortality, and the great gift of finding a true friend in this world. However, as Michael Sims tells us in his wonderful new book called The Story of Charlotte's Web, there was also a much longer incubation period for White's classic, a period that began with his isolated childhood as the youngest of seven children, the snappy creative bustle of the New York newspaper world in the 1920s, which gave White his career and his writing role models, and White's own lifelong struggle with anxiety. That anxiety was soothed in part by writing and by the company of animals. All except, that is, for rats. Take that, Templeton. If you love Charlotte's Web, and please, if you don't, just get help now. Sims' lively and detailed excursion into the mystery of how White's classic came to be is a perfect read for this season, full of grass and insects, pigs and summer rain. The first two-thirds or so of the story of Charlotte's Web recounts White's life up to his 50s, when he began writing his masterpiece. Good as it is, the final section of Sims' book is the real revelation, not only about the influences on Charlotte's Web, but about just how hard it was for White to write, despite the fact that his style always seemed effortless. White was encouraged to attempt children's fiction by his wife, Catherine White, who was the fiction editor of The New Yorker and a regular reviewer of children's literature. She'd urged him to write his first children's book, Stuart Little, which was published in 1945 and had taken him over 6 years to write. White also took inspiration from the 1920s newspaper columnist, Don Marquis, who wrote acclaimed stories about a poetic typing cockroach named Archie. White was adamant that, like Archie, his fictional animal characters should not be cute, but should remain true to their predatory, and in the case of Wilbur, their manure-loving, messy nature. White finished the first draft of the novel in 1951, and then let it sit for a year. He said in a letter to his patient editor that, "I've recently finished another children's book, but have put it away to ripen, let the body heat out of it. It doesn't satisfy me the way it is, and I think eventually I shall rewrite it pretty much." When Charlotte's Web finally came out in October of 1952, most of the reviews were laudatory, except for one, written by Anne Carroll Moore, the influential Children's Division librarian for the New York Public Library. Years earlier, Moore had panned Stuart Little, and now she slammed Charlotte's Web for leaving the human character of Fern undeveloped. White's own later understated estimation of his work is the most touching. In old age, when he was suffering from Alzheimer's, White liked to have his own essays and books read to him. Sometimes White would ask who wrote what he was listening to, and his chief reader, his son Joe, would tell him, "You did, Dad." Sims says that White would think about this odd fact for a moment and sometimes murmur, "Not bad."
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Story of Charlotte's Web by Michael Sims. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.
For weeks, there have been rumblings in Atlanta that news about a school cheating investigation would be bad. Today, Georgia Governor Nathan Deal confirmed it. He released findings of a state investigation into cheating in the Atlanta public school system. Governor Deal said the investigation turned up systematic cheating on a standardized test in 2009. But as Rose Scott of member station WABE explains, it may have been going on for years.
Under the shiny gold dome of Georgia State Capitol, Governor Nathan Deal stood before reporters and announced what he called troubling findings into one of the state's largest public school systems.
We determined that 178 teachers and principals in the Atlanta public school system cheated.
The school district has been under a cloud of suspected cheating for more than a year. That's when another state agency found nearly a quarter million answers were suspiciously erased and changed to correct ones on a standardized test. The test is given each year to elementary and middle school students in the district of 48,000. Most are African American and many are economically disadvantaged. And according to Governor Deal, they are the ones who suffer.
We cannot allow adult behavior to compromise the very tools which we use statewide to gauge a child's proficiency and whether or not he or she is prepared to succeed in the next grade level.
Just last week, the longtime superintendent, Beverly Hall, left the district amid allegations she knew about the cheating and tried to cover it up. Hall was heralded as a savior for the Atlanta public schools. She was credited with improving graduation rates and boosting test scores. In fact, in 2009, she was named the National Superintendent of the Year. Now those achievements are suspect. Fallout from the investigation has been swift today. The school board's chairwoman, Brenda Muhammad, appeared stunned and shaken as she left a private meeting with Georgia's governor just before his public announcement.
Because it's our children, and you just don't cheat children.
It's not clear why the school principals and teachers tampered with the test results that may have begun back in 2001. According to the report, there were warnings that were significant but ignored. The governor did not release the full investigation today, just an outline. He plans to talk to the state attorney general soon and make his findings available to district attorneys for possible criminal prosecutions. For NPR News, I'm Rose Scott in Atlanta.
More in a moment on All Things Considered. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Summer means a lot of happy, sunny things in Florida. But for residents of the Florida Keys, it could also mean the reappearance of a deadly disease. Dengue fever has returned to the Keys for the past two summers after being absent for decades. Dengue is spread by mosquitoes, and Florida is searching for new weapons to fight the bugs. That search has led them to a company in Britain called Oxitec. It's developing genetically modified mosquitoes. And as Jeff Brumfield reports, the company claims its mosquitoes can wipe out the wild kind.
I'm standing in the middle of Oxitec's mosquito breeding lab, which looks like a walk-in meat locker, but feels like a tropical rainforest.
It's actually quite comfortable in here.
You think by spending a few hours, you will change your mind, I believe?
That's Genevieve Labie. She works here. Now, before I go any further, let's get this out of the way. These genetically modified mosquitoes are all normal size, they're not super intelligent or anything like that, and even if one does get out of its cage, which happens occasionally, Labie has a backup plan in hand.
It just looks like a tennis racket, except the mesh is electrified.
Does it hurt? I mean, if you ever touched it?
Do you want to try?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. Ow!
When LaBie isn't swatting mosquitoes or visitors, she's busy injecting hundreds of tiny mosquito eggs with small bits of customized genetic material. The results are these little guys. They look and act normal, but the gene LaBie gives them makes their offspring dependent on a special dietary supplement that they can only get in the lab. Without the supplement, they can't develop normally, says LaBie's boss, Luke Alfie.
If you're really, really nice to them, a few percent, 2 or 3% can survive.
Out in the real world, life gets tougher.
We have no evidence of any survival in the field.
With the electrified tennis racket over there, you might wonder why they're going to all this trouble to come up with a new way to kill mosquitoes. Well, the goal isn't to kill one or two. It's to wipe out whole populations, and in doing so, control diseases they carry like dengue fever. 50 million people catch dengue each year, and it's potentially fatal.
There's no drug, there's no vaccine. Bed nets don't protect you because this mosquito bites during the daytime. So there is only mosquito control.
That's why health officials in the Florida Keys are interested. In 2009, mosquitoes carrying dengue returned to the Keys for the first time in decades. Local authorities don't have a lot of weapons. They can tip out pools of water where mosquitoes lay their eggs or spray insecticides. But in urban environments, these strategies don't work very well. Oxitec has a new plan, and like a lot of good plans, it uses sex. The company breeds a generation of male GM mosquitoes, then releases them to mate with the wild females.
The males will go out and look for the females for you. They're highly developed to do that. You might say that's all they're for. And of course, chemicals will generally not do that.
Field trials in the Cayman Islands last year appear to show it works. Oxitec released its genetically modified males, and Alfie says the population dropped by a whopping 80%. He thinks he could do even better by spreading his killer males over a wider area, and the technology could also be applied to agricultural pests. Now, male mosquitoes don't bite, so the GM version doesn't pose a risk to people, and they can't spread their genes past a generation because their offspring are designed to die. But even then, some environmentalists aren't fans of what Oxitec is doing. One of them is Helen Wallace with the British nonprofit Gene Watch. She's been watching the company's trials in the Cayman Islands and elsewhere, and she's concerned about the mosquitoes.
Yes, it sounds a bit strange to be trying to save mosquitoes, doesn't it? But I think the key issue isn't really whether the species itself should be wiped out. I think we just want to be a lot more sure that it isn't going to cause unintended problems.
Wallace worries that killing lots of mosquitoes could suddenly alter the local ecosystem or even trigger the rise of other disease-carrying animals and cause a new outbreak. She also worries that the technology is moving too quickly for many countries.
Oxitec chose to do its first open release of these mosquitoes in the Cayman Islands, which has no biosafety law and has no environmental information law.
Oxitec's Luke Alfie says the company followed a draft law and worked hard to inform the government and the public. Ultimately, he thinks that GM insects are safe and can work better than insecticides.
What we have is not a panacea or magic bullet that will cure all the world's insect-related ills, but I think it will be a very valuable additional tool.
Many scientists in the U.S. agree, but the tool is unlikely to be available to Florida residents this season. Just like in other countries, U.S. regulators are struggling to come up with rules and safeguards. They're now consulting with researchers and hope to develop a strategy for all GM insects soon. For NPR News, this is Jeff Brumfiel in London.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Now to the latest in our summer series meant to tickle your ears. We're listening to the unique sounds of the season.
It's summertime.
I'm Scott Turow, an attorney and the author, most recently, of Innocent. My summer sound is related to the game of golf. For me, the liberty and lushness of this season is most fully summoned by the cool crack of a tiny ball against the metal face of a driver. In my case, that sound is too often followed by the woodpecker knock of my ball on an oak's limb, the warning screams of my playing companions to other golfers, or even, in one instance, by the honk of an indignant goose I struck with a mishit grounder that left the bird uninjured but outraged. Yet in my mind's ear, there is always the perfect ping of that sphere on the center of my club face and the faintest vacuum as the ball ascends. Golf is an untimed game played in a pastoral space, not merely the grass you tread, but the sky in which your shots travel, all within the borders of the fully leafed forests and ravines and ponds that frame our Midwestern courses, the entire enterprise subject always to the whims of weather. People against nature in the most amiable competition, conducted to the music of wind and water and the peculiar sounds of human striving.
Those images of golf from writer Scott Turow. And you can share your summer sound by going to npr.org. Click on Contact Us, and remember to put the words summer sounds in the subject line of your message.
And let's talk about another political hot-button issue. The Environmental Protection Agency will announce a new rule this week to slash pollution from power plants. This is the kind of regulation that makes businesses grit their teeth and turns the EPA into a punching bag for House Republicans and Republican presidential hopefuls. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports that a new White House study sheds some light on why the agency has become such a target.
Representative Michelle Bachmann echoed a lot of her Republican colleagues' sentiments when she lashed out at the EPA during a CNN presidential debate.
There is no other agency like the EPA. It should really be renamed the Job-Killing Organization of America.
A new report from an unlikely source explains at least in part why the EPA is under fire. The White House Office of Management and Budget says the annual costs of EPA regulations enacted over the last 10 years are more than $23 billion. That's more than the combined costs of regulations from the Departments of Agriculture, Energy, Labor, Justice, Transportation, HHS, and HUD. Some business representatives say the report only captures part of why EPA rules hurt so much.
It's a combination of cost and paperwork and delay that is making a lot of companies feel like they can't really operate in the U.S. anymore.
Industry lawyer Jeffrey Homestead headed EPA's air pollution programs under President Bush. He says there are lots of uncounted costs of EPA rules. For instance, he represents a big power plant project in Texas that's been stalled for 6 months waiting to see if the EPA will require a new kind of permit.
If it weren't for EPA's new greenhouse gas permitting requirements, there would be several thousand jobs being filled in Corpus Christi right now.
Homestead says EPA rules are stifling job growth, but
we've never seen evidence of that. In fact, our rules tend to create jobs.
Gina McCarthy heads the EPA's air programs. She stresses that the same White House report also shows the benefits of EPA rules outweigh their costs by at least 3-1.
We are proving something that many people simply in their gut don't want to believe, which is that the agency is actually successful in bringing public health improvements in a way that doesn't negatively impact the economy.
Many economists agree that the overall benefits outstrip the costs of clean air rules. Harvard economics professor Robert Stavins is one of them. His research shows regulations can create some short-term jobs. Workers are needed to make and install pollution control devices and build cleaner power plants. In the long term, Stavins says, the rules don't have a big impact on jobs one way or another, although you wouldn't know that by listening to the politicians.
What's unfortunate about this is those who support more environmental regulation have promoted it as job creation rather than as environmental protection, and those who are opposed to it, for whatever reasons, have featured it as job killing. In fact, it is neither.
Economists say that the dispute over whether EPA rules kill or create jobs distracts from the undisputed long-term public health benefits that come from these regulations. For example, they reduce asthma attacks and prevent premature deaths from heart and lung failure. Michael Greenstone is an economist at MIT.
Yes, regulations raise the cost of doing business, so it's not surprising that firms that are regulated reduce the number of people they hire. But what you're hoping is that the regulations also produce lots of benefits.
Greenstone says there is plenty of evidence that air pollution regulations produce lots of benefits. Some are predictable and some not. They include fewer infant deaths and higher real estate values because people like to live in places with cleaner air. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.